Chapter 2. What sorts of bullshit jobs are there? My research has revealed 5 basic types of bullshit jobs. In this chapter, I will describe them and outline their essential features. First, a word about this research. I am drawing on 2 large bodies of data. In the wake of my original 2013 essay on the phenomenon of bullshit jobs, a number of newspapers in different countries ran the essay as an opinion piece, and it was also reproduced on a number of blogs. As a result, there was a great deal of online discussion, over the course of which many participants made references to personal experiences of jobs they considered particularly absurd or pointless. I downloaded 124 of these and spent some time sorting through them. The second body of data was actively solicited. In the second half of 2016, I created an email account devoted solely to research and used my Twitter account to encourage people who felt they now or once had a bullshit job to send in firsthand testimonies. I did this by creating an email account, doihaveabsjoborwhat@gmail.com, and asking for input on Twitter. Gmail, rather quaintly, does not allow the word bullshit in addresses. The response was impressive. I ended up assembling over 250 such testimonies, ranging from single paragraphs to 11-page essays detailing whole sequences of bullshit jobs, along with speculations about the organizational or social dynamics that produce them, and descriptions of their social and psychological effects. Most of these testimonies were from citizens of English-speaking countries, but I also received testimonies from all over continental Europe, as well as Mexico, Brazil, Egypt, India, South Africa, and Japan. Some of these were deeply moving, even painful to read. Many were hilarious. Needless to say, almost all respondents insisted their names not be used. The names, therefore, are all made up, and I have avoided naming any specific employers or geographic information that might give identities away. For instance, a famous university in New Haven, Connecticut, or a small publishing firm based in Devon County, England, owned by a consortium in Berlin. In some cases, such details are changed. In other cases, simply left out. After culling the responses and trimming them of extraneous material, I found myself with a database of more than 110,000 words, which I duly color-coded. The results might not be adequate for most forms of statistical analysis, but I found them an extraordinarily rich source for qualitative analysis, especially since in many cases I've been able to ask follow-up questions and, in some, to engage in long conversations with informants. Some of the key concepts I'll be developing in the book were first suggested in or inspired by such conversations. So, in a way, the book can be seen as a collaborative project. This is particularly true of the following typology, which grew directly from these conversations and which I like to see less as my own creation and more as the product of an ongoing dialogue. The quotations that follow are all drawn from this database unless otherwise indicated. I have kept them largely as I received them, except for some light editing, changing abbreviations into full words, adjusting punctuation, minor grammatical or stylistic tweaks, and so forth. The 5 major varieties of bullshit jobs. No typology is perfect, and I'm sure there are many ways one could draw the lines, each revealing in its own way, but over the course of my research, I have found it most useful to break down the types of bullshit job into 5 categories. I will call these flunkies, goons, duct tapers, box tickers, and taskmasters. One BBC video that has been drawn to my attention divides pointless jobs into 3 types. No work at work, managers of management that manage managers, and negative social value. Let us consider each in turn. 1. What flunkies do. Flunky jobs are those that exist only or primarily to make someone else look or feel important. Another term for this category might be feudal retainers. Throughout recorded history, rich and powerful men and women have tended to surround themselves with servants, clients, sycophants, and minions of one sort or another. Not all of these are actually employed in the grandee's household, and many of those who are expected to do at least some actual work. But especially at the top of the pyramid, there is usually a certain portion whose job it is to basically just stand around and look impressive. So, in 1603, one William Perkins wrote, "It is required that such as are commonly called serving men should have, beside the office of waiting, some other particular calling, unless they tend on men of great place and state. For waiting servants, by reason they spend most of their time in eating and drinking, sleeping and gaming after dinner and after supper, do prove the most unprofitable members both in church and commonwealth. For when either their good masters die, or they be turned out of their office for some misdemeanor, they are not fit for any calling, being unable to labor, and thus they give themselves either to beg or to steal." On the history of the term waiter, listen to chapter 6. I should also emphasize that I am not saying real feudal retainers were bullshit jobs in the modern sense, since they rarely felt obliged to claim to be anything other than what they were. Insofar as they misrepresented themselves, it was by pretending to do less than they actually did, not more. You cannot be magnificent without an entourage, and for the truly magnificent, the very uselessness of the uniformed retainers hovering around you is the greatest testimony to your greatness. Well into the Victorian era, for instance, wealthy families in England still employed footmen, liveried servants whose entire purpose was to run alongside carriages checking for bumps in the road. They also ran occasional errands. One gets a sense of how common such characters used to be by how many different words for them there were. Not just footmen, but flunkies, henchmen, gophers, minions, lackeys, cronies, menials, attendants, hirelings, knaves, myrmidons, retainers, and valets. And these are just those that most immediately come to mind. All these are not to be confused with toadies, cronies, sidekicks, sycophants, parasites, stooges, yes-men, and the like, who are more in the order of independent hangers-on. It's worthy of pointing out that in European courts, it was really the courtiers who performed no useful function. The uniformed attendants actually did all sorts of odd jobs when they weren't standing around during ceremonial events. But the whole point was to look as if they didn't. Servants of this sort are normally given some minor task to justify their existence, but this is really just a pretext. In reality, the whole point is to employ handsome young men in flashy uniforms, ready to stand by the door looking regal while you hold court, or to stride gravely in front of you when you enter the room. Often retainers are given military-style costumes and paraphernalia to create the impression that the rich person who employs them has something resembling a palace guard. Such roles tend to multiply in economies based on rent extraction and the subsequent redistribution of the loot. Just as a thought experiment, imagine you were a feudal class extracting 50% of every peasant household's product. If so, you were in possession of an awful lot of food. Enough, in fact, to support a population exactly as large as that of peasant food producers. I recognize that it is extremely rare for the rate of extraction to be that high, but as I say, this is just a thought experiment to bring out the dynamics that tend to emerge in such situations. You have to do something with it, and there are only so many people any given feudal lord can keep around as chefs, wine stewards, scullery maids, harem eunuchs, musicians, jewelers, and the like. Even after you've taken care to ensure you have enough men trained in the use of weapons to suppress any potential rebellion, there's likely to be a great deal left over. As a result, indigents, runaways, orphans, criminals, women in desperate situations, and other dislocated people will inevitably begin to accumulate around your mansion. Because, after all, that's where all the food is. You can drive them away, but then they're likely to form a dangerous vagabond class that might become a political threat. The obvious thing to do is to slap a uniform on them and assign them some minor or unnecessary task. It makes you look good, and at least that way you can keep an eye on them. Now, later, I'm going to suggest that a dynamic not entirely different happens under the existing form of capitalism, but for the moment, all I really want to stress is that assigning people minor tasks as an excuse to have them hang around making you look impressive has a long and honorable history. One might even say it's one of those things of which what we call honor historically consisted of. So, what might the modern equivalent be? Some old-fashioned feudal-style retainer jobs still do exist. The number of domestic servants in North Atlantic countries has declined precipitously since the First World War, but to a large extent, their ranks have been replaced, first by what are called service workers. Waiter, for instance, was originally the name for a kind of household servant, and second, by ever-growing legions of administrative assistants and other such underlings in the corporate sector. For an example of old feudal styles of unnecessary labor bleeding into the present day, consider this account. My friend is working on a film set in an old manor house in Hertfordshire, where he runs errands and ensures that the crew don't mess up the nice old building. At the end of every day, he has to spend 2 solid hours candle watching. The lord and lady of the house told the crew that after the candles are extinguished in the main hall, someone must watch them for at least 2 hours to make sure they don't spontaneously burst into flames again and burn the house down. My friend is not allowed to douse the candles in water or cheat it anyway. When asked why he wasn't allowed to stick the candles in water, he replied, "They gave no explanation." Doormen are the most obvious example. They perform the same function in the houses of the very rich that electronic intercoms have performed for everyone else since at least the 1950s. One former concierge complains, "Bill, another bullshit job. Concierge in one of these buildings. Half my time was spent pressing a button to open the front door for residents and saying hello as they passed through the lobby. If I didn't get to that button in time and a resident had to open the door manually, I'd hear about it from my manager." In some countries, such as Brazil, such buildings still have uniformed elevator operators whose entire job is to push the button for you. There is a continuum from explicit feudal leftovers of this type to receptionists and front desk personnel at places that obviously don't need them. Goethe. In 2010, I worked as a receptionist at a Dutch publishing company. The phone rang maybe once a day, so I was given a couple of other tasks. Keep candy dish full of mints. Mints were supplied by someone else at the company. I just had to take a handful out of a drawer next to the candy dish and put them in the candy dish. Once a week, I would go to a conference room and wind a grandfather clock. I found this task stressful, actually, because they told me that if I forgot or waited too long, all of the weights would fall and I would be left with the onerous task of grandfather clock repair. The task that took the most time was managing another receptionist's Avon sales. Clearly, one call a day could be handled by someone else at the press in the same manner it is in most people's homes. Whoever happens to be the closest to the phone and isn't in the middle of something else picks it up and answers. Why shell out a full-time salary and benefits package for a woman, actually it would seem in this case 2 women, just to sit at the front desk all day doing nothing? The answer is, because not doing so would be shocking and bizarre. No one would take a company seriously if it had no one at all sitting at the front desk. Any publisher who defied convention that blatantly would cause potential authors or merchants or contractors to ask themselves, if they don't feel they have to have a receptionist, what other things that publishers are normally expected to do might they just decide doesn't apply to them? Pay me, for example? Just to be absolutely clear, there are plenty of receptionists who serve a necessary function. I'm referring here to those who do not. Receptionists are required as a badge of seriousness, even if there's nothing else for them to do. Other flunkies are badges of importance. The following account is from Jack, who was hired as a cold caller in a low-level securities trading firm. Such firms, he explains, operate by stolen corporate directories, internal company phone books that some enterprising individual has stolen a physical copy of and then sold to various firms. Brokers then call upper-level employees of the companies and try to pitch them stocks. Jack. My job as a cold caller was to call these people. Not to try to sell them stocks, but rather to offer free research material on a promising company that is about to go public, emphasizing that I was calling on behalf of a broker. That last point was especially stressed to me during my training. The reasoning behind this was that the brokers themselves would seem, to the potential client, to be more capable and professional if they were so damn busy making money that they needed an assistant to make this call for them. There was literally no other purpose to this job than to make my neighbor the broker appear to be more successful than he actually was. I was paid $200 per week, cash, literally from the broker's wallet, for making him look like a high roller. But this didn't just make for social capital for the broker with regards to his clients. In the office itself, being a broker with your own cold caller was a status symbol, and an important one in such a hyper-masculine, hyper-competitive office environment. I was some kind of totem figure for him. Owning me could mean the difference between his getting a meeting with a visiting regional head or not. But for the most part, it just put him on a slightly higher rung on the social ladder of the workplace. The ultimate goal of such brokers being to sufficiently impress their boss that they would be moved from the lowly trading pit to an office of their own upstairs. Jack's conclusion? My position at this company was wholly unnecessary and served no purpose whatsoever other than to make my immediate superior look and feel like a big shot. This is the very definition of a flunky job. The pettiness of the game here, even in the 1990s, $200 was not a lot of money, helps lay bare dynamics that might express themselves in more opaque ways in larger and more complex corporate environments. There we often find cases where no one is entirely sure how or why certain positions were invented and maintained. Here is Ophelia, who works for an organization that runs social marketing campaigns. Ophelia. My current job title is Portfolio Coordinator, and everyone always asks what that means or what it is I actually do. I have no idea. I'm still trying to figure it out. My job description says all sorts of stuff about facilitating relationships between partners, etc., which, as far as I'm concerned, just means answering occasional queries. It has occurred to me that my actual title refers to a bullshit job. However, the reality of my working life is functioning as a personal assistant to the director. And in that role, I do have actual work tasks that need doing, simply because the people I assist are either too busy or too important to do this stuff themselves. In fact, most of the time, I seem to be the only one at my workplace who has something to do. Some days, I run around frantically, whilst most of the mid-level managers sit around and stare at a wall, seemingly bored to death and just trying to kill time doing pointless things. Like that one guy who rearranges his backpack for a half hour every day. Obviously, there isn't enough work to keep most of us occupied, but in a weird logic that probably just makes them all feel more important about their own jobs, we are now recruiting another manager. Maybe this is to keep up the illusion that there's so much to do? Ophelia suspects her job was originally just an empty place filler, created so that someone could boast about the number of employees he had working under him. But once it was created, a perverse dynamic began to set in, whereby managers offloaded more and more of their responsibilities onto the lowest-ranking female subordinate, her, to give the impression that they were too busy to do such things themselves, leading, of course, to their having even less to do than previously, a spiral culminating in the apparently bizarre decision to hire another manager to stare at the wall or play Pokemon all day, just because hiring him would make it look like that was not what everyone else was doing. Ophelia ends up sometimes working frenetically, in part because the few necessary tasks handed off to her are augmented with completely made-up responsibilities designed to keep low-level staff bustling. Ophelia. We are divided between two organizations and two buildings. If my boss, the boss of the whole place in fact, goes to the other building, I have to fill in a form to book a room for her. Every time. It is absolute insanity, but it certainly keeps the receptionist over there very busy and therefore indispensable. It also makes her appear very organized, juggling and filing all this paperwork. It occurs to me that this is what they really mean in job ads when they say that they expect you to make office procedures more efficient, that you create more bureaucracy to fill the time. Ophelia's example highlights a common ambiguity. Whose job is really bullshit? That of the flunky or the boss? Sometimes, as we've seen with Jack, it's clearly the former. The flunky really does only exist to make his or her immediate superior look or feel important. In cases like that, no one minds if the flunky does absolutely nothing. Steve. I just graduated, and my new job basically consists of my boss forwarding emails to me with the message, "Steve, refer to the below," and I reply that the email is inconsequential or straight-up spam. In other cases, as with Ophelia, the flunkies end up effectively doing the boss's jobs for them. This, of course, was the traditional role of female secretaries, now relabeled administrative assistants, working for male executives during most of the 20th century. While, in theory, secretaries were there just to answer the phone, take dictation, and do some light filing, in fact, they often ended up doing 80% to 90% of their boss's jobs, and sometimes 100% of its non-bullshit aspects. It would be fascinating, though probably impossible, to write a history of books, designs, plans, and documents attributed to famous men that were actually written by their secretaries. The same remains true today, incidentally. I am personally acquainted with one young woman who, despite having no military experience whatsoever, ended up as personal assistant to a NATO official, actually writing many strategic plans for operations in a war zone. Neither do I have any reason to believe her plans weren't just as good or better than any NATO general would have come up with. So in such cases, who has the bullshit job? Here again, I think we are forced to fall back on the subjective element. The middle manager in Ophelia's office reorganizing his backpack for a half hour every day may or may not have been willing to admit his job was pointless, but those hired just to make someone like him seem important almost invariably know it and resent it, even when it doesn't involve making up unnecessary busy work. Judy. The only full-time job I ever had in human resources in a private sector engineering firm was wholly not necessary. It was there only because the HR specialist was lazy and didn't want to leave his desk. I was an HR assistant. My job took, I shit you not, 1 hour a day, an hour and a half max. The other 7 or so hours were spent playing 2048 or watching YouTube. Phone never rang. Data were entered in 5 minutes or less. I got paid to be bored. My boss could have easily done my job yet again. Fucking lazy turd. When I was doing anthropological fieldwork in Highland Madagascar, I noticed that wherever one found the tomb of a famous nobleman, one also invariably found 2 or 3 modest graves directly at its foot. When I asked what these modest graves were, I would always be told these were his soldiers. Really, a euphemism for slaves. The meaning was clear. To be an aristocrat meant to have the power to order others around. Even in death, if you didn't have underlings, you couldn't really claim to be a noble. An analogous logic seems to be at work in corporate environments. Why did the Dutch publishing outfit need a receptionist? Because a company has to have 3 levels of command in order to be considered a real company. At the very least, there must be a boss and editors, and those editors have to have some sort of underlings or assistants. At the very minimum, the one receptionist who is a kind of collective underling to all of them. Otherwise, you wouldn't be a corporation, but just some kind of hippie collective. Once the unnecessary flunky is hired, whether or not that flunky ends up being given anything to do is an entirely secondary consideration. That depends on a whole list of extraneous factors. For instance, whether or not there is any work to do, the needs and attitudes of the superiors, gender dynamics, and institutional constraints. If the organization grows in size, higher-ups' importance will almost invariably be measured by the total number of employees working under them, which, in turn, creates an even more powerful incentive for those on top of the organizational ladder to either hire employees and only then decide what they are going to do with them, or, even more often perhaps, to resist any efforts to eliminate jobs that are found to be redundant. As we'll see, testimonies from consultants hired to introduce efficiencies in a large corporation, say a bank or a medical supply corporation, attest to the awkward silences and outright hostility that ensue when executives realize those efficiencies will have the effect of automating away a significant portion of their subordinates. By doing so, they would effectively reduce managers to nothing. Kings of the air. For without flunkies, to whom exactly would they be superior? 2. What goons do. The use of this term is, of course, metaphorical. I'm not using it to mean actual gangsters or other forms of hired muscle. Rather, I'm referring to people whose jobs have an aggressive element, but crucially, who exist only because other people employ them. The most obvious example of this are national armed forces. Countries need armies only because other countries have armies. If no one had an army, armies would not be needed. At the very least, this is true of high-tech weaponry. One might argue that most countries also maintain armies to suppress real or potential civil unrest, but this rarely involves a need for fighter jets, submarines, or MX missiles. Historically, Mexico has had an explicit policy of not wasting money on such expensive toys, arguing that, owing to their geographic position, the only countries they'd be likely to enter into hostilities with would be either the USA or Guatemala. If they went to war with the USA, they'd lose, pretty much regardless of armament. If they went to war with Guatemala, they'd win, with or without fighter jets. Hence, Mexico merely maintained such equipment as would suffice to suppress domestic dissent. But the same can be said of most lobbyists, PR specialists, telemarketers, and corporate lawyers. Also, like literal goons, they have a largely negative impact on society. I think almost anyone would concur that, were all telemarketers to disappear, the world would be a better place. But I think most would also agree that if all corporate lawyers, bank lobbyists, or marketing gurus were to similarly vanish in a puff of smoke, the world would be at least a little bit more bearable. The obvious question is, are these really bullshit jobs at all? Would these not be more like the mafia hitmen of the last chapter? After all, in most cases, goons are clearly doing something to further the interests of those who employ them, even if the overall effect of their profession's existence might be considered detrimental to humanity as a whole. Here again, we must appeal to the subjective element. Sometimes the ultimate pointlessness of a line of work is so obvious that few involved make much effort to deny it. Most universities in the United Kingdom now have public relations offices with staffs several times larger than would be typical for, say, a bank or an auto manufacturer of roughly the same size. Does Oxford really need to employ a dozen plus PR specialists to convince the public it's a top-notch university? I'd imagine it would take at least that many PR agents quite a number of years to convince the public Oxford was not a top-notch university, and even then, I suspect the task would prove impossible. Obviously, I'm being slightly facetious here. This is not the only thing a PR department does. I'm sure in the case of Oxford, much of its day-to-day concerns involve more practical matters, such as attracting to the university the children of oil magnates or corrupt politicians from foreign lands who might otherwise have gone to Cambridge. But still, those in charge of public relations, strategic communications, and the like at many elite universities in the UK have sent me testimonies making it clear that they do indeed feel their jobs are largely pointless. I have included goons as a category of bullshit job largely for this reason, because so many of those who hold them feel their jobs have no social value and ought not to exist. Recall the words of the tax litigator from the preface. I am a corporate lawyer, I contribute nothing to this world, and am utterly miserable all of the time. Unfortunately, it is almost impossible to ascertain how many corporate lawyers secretly share this feeling. The YouGov survey did not break down its results by profession, and while my own research confirms such feelings are by no means unique, none of those who reported such attitudes were particularly high level. The same is true of those who work in marketing or PR. The reason I thought the word goon appropriate is because in almost all cases, goons find their jobs objectionable, not just because they feel they lack positive value, but also because they see them as essentially manipulative and aggressive. Tom, I work for a very large American-owned post-production company based in London. There are parts of my job that have always been very enjoyable and fulfilling. I get to make cars fly, buildings explode, and dinosaurs attack alien spaceships for movie studios, providing entertainment for audiences worldwide. More recently, however, a growing percentage of our customers are advertising agencies. They bring us adverts for well-known branded products, shampoos, toothpaste, moisturizing creams, washing powders, etc., and we use visual effects trickery to make it seem like these products actually work. We also work on TV shows and music videos. We reduce bags under the eyes of women, make hair shinier, teeth whiter, make pop stars and film stars look thinner, etc. We airbrush skin to remove spots, isolate the teeth and color correct them to make them whiter, also done on the clothes and washing powder ads. Paint out split ends and add shiny highlights to hair and shampoo commercials, and there are special deforming tools to make people thinner. These techniques are literally used in every commercial on TV, plus most TV drama shows and lots of movies, particularly on female actors, but also on men. We essentially make viewers feel inadequate whilst they're watching the main programs, and then exaggerate the effectiveness of the solutions provided in the commercial breaks. I get paid £100,000 a year to do this. When I asked why he considered his job to be bullshit, as opposed to merely, say, evil, Tom replied, "Tom, I consider a worthwhile job to be one that fulfills a pre-existing need, or creates a product or service that people hadn't thought of, that somehow enhances and improves their lives. I believe we passed the point where most jobs were these types of jobs a long time ago. Supply has far outpaced demand in most industries, so now it is demand that is manufactured. My job is a combination of manufacturing demand and then exaggerating the usefulness of the products sold to fix it. In fact, you could argue that that is the job of every single person that works in or for the entire advertising industry. If we're at the point where in order to sell products, you have to first of all trick people into thinking they need them, then I think you'd be hard-pressed to argue that these jobs aren't bullshit." Such conversations are particularly challenging to me since, in the 1980s, academics such as myself largely abandoned the idea that consumer demand was the product of marketing manipulation and took up the idea that consumers were basically patching together crazy quilt identities by using consumer goods in ways that had never really been intended, as if everyone in America had turned into Snoop Dogg or RuPaul. Granted, I was always pretty suspicious of that narrative, but it's clear that many of those who work in the industry are quite certain that they really are what everyone thought they were in the 60s and 70s. In advertising, marketing, and publicity, discontent of this sort runs so high that there is even a magazine, Adbusters, produced entirely by workers in the industry who resent what they are made to do for a living and wish to use the powers they've acquired in advertising for good instead of evil. For instance, by designing flashy subvertising that attacks consumer culture as a whole. Tom, for his part, didn't consider his job bullshit because he objected to consumer culture in itself. He objected because he saw his beauty work, as he called it, as inherently coercive and manipulative. He was drawing a distinction between what might be called honest illusions and dishonest ones. When you make dinosaurs attack spaceships, no one actually thinks that's real. Much as with a stage magician, half the fun is that everyone knows a trick is being played. They just don't know exactly how it's done. When you subtly enhance the appearance of celebrities, in contrast, you are trying to change viewers' unconscious assumptions about what everyday reality, in this case of men's and women's bodies, ought to be like, so as to create an uncomfortable feeling that their lived reality is itself an inadequate substitute for the real thing. Where honest illusions add joy into the world, dishonest ones are intentionally aimed toward convincing people their worlds are a tawdry and miserable sort of place. Similarly, I received a very large number of testimonies from call center employees. None considered his or her job bullshit because of conditions of employment. Actually, these appeared to vary enormously from nightmarish levels of surveillance to surprisingly relaxed, but because the work involved tricking or pressuring people into doing things that weren't really in their best interest. Here's a sampling. I had a bunch of bullshit call center jobs selling things that people didn't really want slash need, taking insurance claims, conducting pointless market research. It's a bait and switch, offering a free service first, and then asking you for $1.95 for a 2-week trial subscription in order for you to finish the process and get you what you went on the website to acquire, and then signing you up for an auto renewal for a monthly service that's more than 10 times that amount. It's not just a lack of positive contribution, but you're making an active negative contribution to people's day. I called people up to hawk them useless shit they didn't need, specifically access to their credit score that they could obtain for free elsewhere, but that we were offering, with some mindless add-ons, for £6.99 a month. Most of the support covered basic computer operations the customer could easily Google. They were geared toward old people, or those that didn't know better, I think. Our call center's resources are almost wholly devoted to coaching agents on how to talk people into things they don't need, as opposed to solving the real problems they're calling about. So once again, what really irks is, one, the aggression, and two, the deception. Here, I can speak from personal experience, having done such jobs, albeit usually very, very briefly. There are few things less pleasant than being forced against your better nature to try to convince others to do things that defy their common sense. I will be discussing this issue in greater depth in the next chapter, on spiritual violence, but for now, let us merely note that this is at the very heart of what it is to be a goon. 3. What duct tapers do. Duct tapers are employees whose jobs exist only because of a glitch or fault in the organization, who are there to solve a problem that ought not to exist. I am adopting the term from the software industry, but I think it has more general applicability. One testimony from a software developer describes the industry like this. Pablo. Basically, we have two kinds of jobs. One kind involves working on core technologies, solving hard and challenging problems, etc. The other one is taking a bunch of core technologies and applying some duct tape to make them work together. The former is generally seen as useful. The latter is often seen as less useful or even useless, but in any case, much less gratifying than the first kind. The feeling is probably based on the observation that if core technologies were done properly, there would be little or no need for duct tape. Pablo's main point is that with the growing reliance on free software, freeware, paid employment is increasingly reduced to duct taping. Coders are often happy to perform the interesting and rewarding work on core technologies for free at night, but since that means they have less and less incentive to think about how such creations will ultimately be made compatible, that means the same coders are reduced during the day to the tedious but paid work of making them fit together. This is a very important insight, and I'll be discussing some of its implications at length later. But for now, let's just consider the notion of duct taping itself. Cleaning is a necessary function. Things get dusty even if they just sit there, and the ordinary conduct of life tends to leave traces that need to be tidied up. But cleaning up after someone who makes a completely gratuitous and unnecessary mess is always irritating. Having a full-time occupation cleaning up after such a person can only breed resentment. Sigmund Freud even spoke of housewife's neurosis, a condition that he believed affected women forced to limit their life horizons to tidying up after others, and who therefore became fanatical about domestic hygiene as a form of revenge. This is often the moral agony of the duct taper. To be forced to organize one's working life around caring about a certain value, say cleanliness, precisely because more important people could not care less. The most obvious examples of duct tapers are underlings whose jobs are to undo the damage done by sloppy or incompetent superiors. Magda. I once worked for an SME, a small or medium-sized enterprise, where I was the tester. I was required to proofread research reports written by their posh star researcher statistician. The man didn't know the first thing about statistics, and he struggled to produce grammatically correct sentences. He tended to avoid using verbs. He was so bad, I'd reward myself with a cake if I found a coherent paragraph. I lost 12 pounds working in that company. My job was to convince him to undertake a major reworking of every report he produced. Of course, he would never agree to correct anything, let alone undertake a rework, so I would then have to take the report to the company directors. They were statistically illiterate too, but being the directors, they could drag things out even more. There is, it seems, a whole genre of jobs that involve correcting the damage done by a superior who holds his position for reasons unrelated to ability to do the work. This overlaps somewhat with flunky positions where the job holder has to do the superior's work, but it's not exactly the same thing. Here's another example of a programmer who got a job for a firm run by a Viennese psychologist who fancied himself an old-style scientific revolutionary, and who had invented what was, in the company, referred to simply as the algorithm. The algorithm aimed to reproduce human speech. The company sold it to pharmacists to use on their websites. Except, it didn't work. Nuri. The company's founding genius was this Viennese research psychologist who claimed to have discovered the algorithm. For many months, I was never allowed to see it. I just wrote stuff that used it. The psychologist's code kept failing to give sensible results. Typical cycle. I demonstrate his code barfs on a ridiculously basic sentence. He'd wear a confused frown. Oh, how strange. Like I just discovered the Death Star's one tiny weakness. He'd disappear into his cave for 2 hours. Triumphantly emerges with bug fix. Now, it's perfect. Go to step one. In the end, the programmer was reduced to writing very primitive ELISA scripts, a crude natural language script dating back to the late 1960s, to mimic speech for the web pages just to cover up the fact that the algorithm was basically gibberish, and the company, it turned out, was a pure vanity project run by a rented CEO who used to manage a gym. Many duct taper jobs are the result of a glitch in the system that no one has bothered to correct. Tasks that could easily be automated, for instance, but haven't been, either because no one has gotten around to it, or because the manager wants to maintain as many subordinates as possible, or because of some structural confusion, or because of some combination of the three. I have any number of testimonies of this sort. Here's a sampling. I worked as a programmer for a travel company. Some poor person's job was to receive updated plane timetables via email several times a week and copy them by hand into Excel. My job was to transfer information about the state's oil wells into a different set of notebooks than they were currently in. My day consisted of photocopying veterans' health records for 7.5 hours a day. Workers were told time and again that it was too costly to buy the machines for digitizing. I was given one responsibility, watching an inbox that received emails in a certain form from employees in the company asking for tech help, and copy and paste it into a different form. Not only was this a textbook example of an automatable job, it actually used to be automated. There was some kind of disagreement between various managers that led to higher-ups issuing a standardization that nullified the automation. On the social level, duct taping has traditionally been women's work. Throughout history, prominent men have wandered about oblivious to half of what's going on around them, treading on 1,000 toes. It was typically their wives, sisters, mothers, or daughters who are left with the responsibility of performing the emotional labor of soothing egos, calming nerves, and negotiating solutions to the problems they created. In a more material sense, duct taping might be considered a classic working-class function. The architect may come up with a plan that looks stunning on paper, but it's the builder who has to figure out how to actually install electrical sockets in a circular room, or to use real duct tape to hold things together that in reality simply don't fit together the way the blueprints say they should. In this latter case, we're not really talking about a bullshit job at all, any more than we're talking about a bullshit job when an orchestra conductor interprets the score of a Beethoven symphony, or an actress plays Lady Macbeth. There will always be a certain gap between blueprints, schemas, and plans and their real-world implementation. Therefore, there will always be people charged with making the necessary adjustments. What makes such a role bullshit is when the plan obviously can't work, and any competent architect should have known it. When the system is so stupidly designed that it will fail in completely predictable ways, but rather than fix the problem, the organization prefers to hire full-time employees whose main or entire job is to deal with the damage. It's as if a homeowner, upon discovering a leak in the roof, decided it was too much bother to hire a roofer to reshingle it and instead stuck a bucket underneath and hired someone whose full-time job was to periodically dump the water. It goes without saying that duct tapers are almost always aware they have a bullshit job and are usually quite angry about it. I encountered a classic example of a duct taper while working as a lecturer at a prominent British university. One day, the wall shelves in my office collapsed. This left books scattered all over the floor and a jagged, half-dislocated metal frame that once held the shelves in place dangling cheerfully over my desk. A carpenter appeared an hour later to inspect the damage, but announced gravely that, since there were books all over the floor, safety rules prevented him from entering the room or taking further action. I would have to stack the books and then not touch anything else, whereupon he would return at the earliest available opportunity to remove the dangling frame. I duly stacked the books, but the carpenter never reappeared. There ensued a series of daily calls from anthropology to buildings and grounds. Each day, someone in the anthropology department would call, often multiple times, to ask about the fate of the carpenter, who always turned out to have something extremely pressing to do. By the time a week was out, I had taken to doing my work on the floor in a kind of little nest assembled from fallen books, and it had become apparent that there was one man employed by Buildings and Grounds whose entire job it was to apologize for the fact that the carpenter hadn't come. He seemed like a nice man. He was exceedingly polite and even-tempered, and always had just a slight trace of wistful melancholy about him, which made him quite well-suited for the job. Still, it's hard to imagine he was particularly happy with his choice of career. Most of all, there didn't seem any obvious reason the school couldn't simply get rid of the position and use the money to hire another carpenter, in which case his job would not be needed anyway. 4. What box tickers do. I am using the term box tickers to refer to employees who exist only or primarily to allow an organization to be able to claim it is doing something that, in fact, it is not doing. The following testimony is from a woman hired to coordinate leisure activities in a care home. Betsy. Most of my job was to interview residents and fill out a recreation form that listed their preferences. That form was then logged on a computer and promptly forgotten about forever. The paper form was also kept in a binder, for some reason. Completion of the forms was by far the most important part of my job in the eyes of my boss, and I would catch hell if I got behind on them. A lot of the time, I would complete a form for a short-term resident, and they would check out the next day. I threw away mountains of paper. The interviews mostly just annoyed the residents, as they knew it was just bullshit paperwork, and no one was going to care about their individual preferences. The most miserable thing about box-ticking jobs is that the employee is usually aware that not only does the box-ticking exercise do nothing toward accomplishing its ostensible purpose, it actually undermines it, since it diverts time and resources away from the purpose itself. So here, Betsy was aware that the time she spent processing forms about how residents might wish to be entertained was time not spent entertaining them. She did manage to engage in some leisure activities with the residents. Fortunately, I was able to play the piano for the residents every day before dinner, and that was a beautiful time with singing, smiling, and tears. But as so often in such situations, there was a sense that these moments were indulgences granted her as a reward for carrying out her primary duties, which consisted of the filling out and proper disposition of forms. I have personal experience of this. Lecturers at LSE are expected to fill out elaborate time allocation reports with an hour-by-hour breakdown of weekly professional activities. The forms offer endless fine distinctions between different sorts of administrative activity, but no explicit category for reading and writing books. When I pointed this out, I was told I could place such activities under LSE-funded research. That is, what was important about research from the school's perspective was, one, that I had not got myself outside funding to pay for this reading and writing activity, and two, that therefore they were paying me to do it when I could be doing my real job. We're all familiar with box ticking as a form of government. If a government's employees are caught doing something very bad, taking bribes, for instance, or regularly shooting citizens at traffic stops, the first reaction is invariably to create a fact-finding commission to get to the bottom of things. This serves two functions. First of all, it's a way of insisting that, aside from a small group of miscreants, no one had any idea that any of this was happening. This, of course, is rarely true. Second of all, it's a way of implying that once all the facts are in, someone will definitely do something about it. This is usually not true either. A fact-finding commission is a way of telling the public that the government is doing something it is not. But large corporations will behave in exactly the same way if, say, they are revealed to be employing slaves or child laborers in their garment factories or dumping toxic waste. All of this is bullshit, but the true bullshit job category applies to those who are not just there to stave off the public. This at least could be said to serve some kind of useful purpose for the company, but to those who do so within the organization itself. A fairly typical testimony from within the IT industry. I have often seen projects designed to obscure responsibility. For example, to evaluate an IT system. The purpose is not to affect the decision, which is taken somewhere in the corridors, but to claim that everyone was heard and all concerns were taken seriously. Since the project is only a pretense, all work on the project is wasted, and people soon realize and stop taking it seriously. This kind of false consensus is common in ostensibly collegial institutions like universities or NGOs, but is quite common in the more hierarchical corporations as well. The corporate compliance industry might be considered an intermediary form. It is explicitly created by U.S. government regulation. Layla. I work in a growing industry born out of the federal regulation, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Basically, U.S. companies have to do due diligence to make sure they aren't doing business with corrupt overseas firms. Clients are big companies, tech, auto companies, etc., who might have myriad smallish businesses they supply or work with in places like China, my region. Our company creates due diligence reports for our clients. Basically, 1 to 2 hours of internet research that is then edited into a report. There is a lot of jargon and training that goes into making sure every report is consistent. Sometimes the internet reveals something that's an easy red flag, like a company's boss had a criminal case, but I would say the realness/bullshit factor is 20 to 80. Unless someone has been criminally charged, I have no way of knowing from my apartment in Brooklyn if they've been handed an envelope full of cash in Guangzhou. To give a sense of the scale of this industry, Citigroup announced in 2014 that by the next year, it would have 30,000 employees working in compliance, or about 13% of the total staff. Of course, on some level, all bureaucracies work on this principle. Once you introduce formal measures of success, reality, for the organization, becomes that which exists on paper, and the human reality that lies behind it is a secondary consideration at best. I vividly remember the endless discussions that ensued when I was a junior professor at Yale University about a first-year archaeology graduate student whose husband had died in a car crash on the first day of the term. For some reason, the shock caused her to develop a mental block on doing paperwork. She still attended lectures and was an avid participant in class discussions, and she turned in papers and got excellent grades. But eventually, the professor would always discover she hadn't formally signed up for the class. As the Eminence Grise of the department would point out during faculty meetings, that was all that really mattered. As far as the guys in registration are concerned, if you don't get the forms in on time, you don't take the course. So your performance is completely irrelevant. Other professors would mumble and fuss, and there would be occasional careful allusions to her personal tragedy, the exact nature of which was never specified. I had to learn about it from other students later on. But no one raised any fundamental objections to registration's attitude. That was just reality, from an administrative point of view. Eventually, after last-minute attempts to have her fill out a sheaf of late application appeal documents also met with no response, and after numerous long soliloquies from the Director of Graduate Studies about just how inconsiderate it was of her to make things so difficult for those who were only trying to help her, except, of course, by trying to make some special arrangement that would allow someone else to do the paperwork for her, this was considered, for some reason, quite out of the question. The student was expelled from the program on the grounds that anyone so incapable of handling paperwork was obviously not suited for an academic career. This mentality seems to increase, not decrease, when government functions are reorganized to be more like a business, and citizens, for example, are redefined as customers. Mark is senior quality and performance officer in a local council in the United Kingdom. Mark: most of what I do, especially since moving away from frontline customer-facing roles, involves ticking boxes, pretending things are great to senior managers, and generally feeding the beast with meaningless numbers that give the illusion of control, none of which helps the citizens of that council in the slightest. I've heard an apocryphal story about a chief executive who turned on the fire alarm so all the staff gathered in the car park. He then told all the employees who were with a customer when the alarm went off to return to the building immediately. The other employees could return when one of the people dealing with a customer needed them for something, and so on and so forth. If this had happened when I was at that council, I would have been in the car park for a very long time. Mark goes on to describe local government as little more than an endless sequence of box-ticking rituals revolving around monthly target figures. These were put up on posters in the office and coded green for improving, amber for stable, and red for decline. Supervisors appeared innocent even of the basic concept of random statistical variation, or at least pretended to be, as each month, those with green-coded figures were rewarded, while those with red urged to do a better job. Almost none of this had any real bearing on providing services. Mark: one project I worked on was to come up with some housing service standards. The project involved playing lip service to customers and having long discussions with managers at meetings before finally writing up a report that got praised, mainly because it was presented and laid out attractively, by managers in the meeting. The report then got filed away, making absolutely no difference to the residents, but still somehow requiring many hours of staff time, not to mention all the hours the residents themselves spent filling in surveys or attending focus groups. In my experience, this is how most policy works in local government. Another good example of a public-private box-ticking industry is in construction. Consider the following testimony. Sophie. I'm in this lucrative consultant line of work for planning permissions. Back in the 60s, just about the only consultant who submitted information for a planning permission was the architect. Now, a planning permission for a large-ish building is accompanied by a long list of reports by consultants, including me. Environmental impact assessment, landscape and visual impact assessment, transport report, wind microclimate assessment, sunlight/daylight analysis, heritage setting assessment, archaeology assessment, landscape maintenance management report, tree impact assessment, flood risk assessment, and there's more than that. Each report is about 50 to 100 pages, and yet the strange thing is, the resulting buildings are ugly boxes remarkably similar to the ones we built in the 60s, so I don't think the reports are serving any purpose. Note here the importance of the physical attractiveness of the report. This is a theme that comes up frequently in testimonies about box-ticking operations, and even more so in the corporate sector than in government. If the ongoing importance of a manager is measured by how many people he has working under him, the immediate material manifestation of that manager's power and prestige is the visual quality of his presentations and reports. The meetings in which such emblems are displayed might be considered the high rituals of the corporate world. And just as the retinues of a feudal lord might include servants whose only role, or only ostensible role, was to polish his horse's armor or tweeze his mustache before tournaments or pageants, so may present-day executives keep employees whose sole purpose is to prepare their PowerPoint presentations or craft the maps, cartoons, photographs, or illustrations that accompany their reports. Many of these reports are nothing more than props in a kabuki-like corporate theater. No one actually reads them all the way through. One corporate consultant wrote, "I look forward to the day that someone in my industry steps up and goes full SoCal affair," i.e., submits a consulting report that is entirely made up of vague business buzzwords and doesn't actually contain any structured information at all. Although I suspect this has already happened many times, just without the consultants in question being conscious of it. But this doesn't stop ambitious executives from cheerfully shelling out half a workman's yearly wages of company money just to be able to say, "Ooh, yes, we commissioned a report on that." Hannibal. I do digital consultancy for global pharmaceutical companies' marketing departments. I often work with global PR agencies on this and write reports with titles like "How to Improve Engagement Among Key Digital Healthcare Stakeholders." It is pure, unadulterated bullshit and serves no purpose beyond ticking boxes for marketing departments. But it is very easy to charge a very large amount of money to write bullshit reports. I was recently able to charge around £12,000 to write a 2-page report for a pharmaceutical client to present during a global strategy meeting. The report wasn't used in the end because they didn't manage to get to that agenda point during their allotted meeting time, but the team I wrote it for was very happy with it nonetheless. There are whole minor industries that exist just to facilitate such box-ticking gestures. I worked for some years for the Interlibrary Loan Office in the University of Chicago Science Library, and at least 90% of what people did there was photocopy and mail out articles from medical journals with titles such as The Journal of Cell Biology, Clinical Endocrinology, and The American Journal of Internal Medicine. I was lucky, I did something else. For the first few months, I was under the naive impression that these articles were being sent to doctors. To the contrary, a bemused coworker eventually explained to me, the overwhelming majority were being sent to lawyers. This made sense in retrospect, because if you are a medical researcher, you already have all these journals in the library or have access to digitized versions. There would be no reason to fall back on interlibrary loan. Apparently, if you are suing a doctor for malpractice, part of the show involves assembling an impressive pile of scientific papers to plunk down on the table at an appropriately theatrical moment and then enter into evidence. While everyone knows that no one will actually read these papers, there is always the possibility that the defense attorney or one of his expert witnesses might pick one up at random for inspection. So it is considered important to ensure your legal aids locate articles that can at least plausibly be said to bear in some way on the case. As we will see in later chapters, there are all sorts of different ways that private companies employ people to be able to tell themselves they are doing something that they aren't really doing. Many large corporations, for instance, maintain their own in-house magazines or even television channels, the ostensible purpose of which is to keep employees up to date on interesting news and developments, but which, in fact, exist for almost no reason other than to allow executives to experience that warm and pleasant feeling that comes when you see a favorable story about you in the media, or to know what it's like to be interviewed by people who look and act exactly like reporters, but never ask questions you wouldn't want them to ask. Such venues tend to reward their writers, producers, and technicians very handsomely, often at 2 or 3 times the market rate. But I've never talked to anyone who does such work full-time who doesn't say the job is bullshit. It's interesting to compare corporate magazines with the ones that labor unions put out, which I suspect predate them as a literary form. They certainly have their share of puff pieces, but also discuss serious problems. My father was a member of Amalgamated Lithographers Local 1 in New York, a printers union, and I remember as a child taking pride in the fact that their in-house magazine, Lithopinion, was by far the most beautiful magazine I'd ever seen, owing to their eagerness to show off new graphic techniques. It also contained real, hard-hitting political analysis. 5. What taskmasters do. Taskmasters fall into 2 subcategories. Type 1 contains those whose role consists entirely of assigning work to others. This job can be considered bullshit if the taskmaster herself believes that there is no need for her intervention, and that if she were not there, underlings would be perfectly capable of carrying on by themselves. Type 1 taskmasters can thus be considered the opposite of flunkies. Unnecessary superiors rather than unnecessary subordinates. Whereas the first variety of taskmaster is merely useless, the second variety does actual harm. These are taskmasters whose primary role is to create bullshit tasks for others to do, to supervise bullshit, or even to create entirely new bullshit jobs. One might also refer to them as bullshit generators. Type 2 taskmasters may also have real duties in addition to their role as taskmaster, but if all or most of what they do is create bullshit tasks for others, then their own jobs can be classified as bullshit too. As one might imagine, it is especially difficult to gather testimonies from taskmasters. Even if they do secretly think their jobs are useless, they are much less likely to admit it. For instance, a recent survey determined that 80% of employees feel their managers are useless and that they could do their job just as well without them. It does not appear to document how many managers agree, but one has to assume the number is substantially lower. But I found a small number willing to come clean. Ben represents a classic example of type 1. He is a middle manager. Ben: I have a bullshit job, and it happens to be in middle management. 10 people work for me, but from what I can tell, they can all do the work without my oversight. My only function is to hand them work, which I suppose the people that actually generate the work could do themselves. I will say that in a lot of cases, the work that is assigned is a product of other managers with bullshit jobs, which makes my job 2 levels of bullshit. I just got promoted to this job, and I spend a lot of my time looking around and wondering what I'm supposed to be doing. As best I can tell, I'm supposed to be motivating the workers. I sort of doubt that I'm earning my salary doing that, even if I'm really trying. Ben calculates that he spends at least 75% of his time allocating tasks and then monitoring if the underling is doing them, even though he insists he has absolutely no reason to believe the underlings in question would behave any differently if he weren't there. He also says he keeps trying to allocate himself real work on the sly, but when he does so, his own superiors eventually notice and tell him to cut it out. But then, when he sent in his testimony, Ben had only been at the job for 2.5 months, which might explain his candor. If he does succumb eventually and accepts his new role in life, he will come to understand that, as another testimony put it, the entire job of middle management is to ensure the lower-level people hit their productivity numbers, and will therefore start coming up with formal statistical metrics that his underlings can try to falsify. Being forced to supervise people who don't need supervision is actually a fairly common complaint. Here, for instance, is the testimony of an assistant localization manager named Alfonso. Alfonso: my job is to oversee and coordinate a team of 5 translators. The problem with that is that the team is perfectly capable of managing itself. They are trained in all the tools they need to use, and they can, of course, manage their time and tasks. So I normally act as a task gatekeeper. Requests come to me through Jira, a bureaucratic online tool for managing tasks, and I pass them on to the relevant person or persons. Other than that, I'm in charge of sending periodic reports to my manager, who, in turn, will incorporate them into more important reports to be sent to the CEO. This kind of combination of task mastering and box ticking would appear to be the very essence of middle management. In Alfonso's case, he did actually serve one useful function, but only because his team of translators, based in Ireland, was assigned so little work by the central office in Japan that he had to constantly figure out ways to finagle the reports to make it look like they were very busy and no one needed to be laid off. Let us move on then to taskmasters of the second type, those who make up bullshit for others to do. We may begin with Chloe, who held the post of academic dean at a prominent British university, with a specific responsibility to provide strategic leadership to a troubled campus. Now, those of us toiling in the academic mills who still like to think of ourselves as teachers and scholars before all else have come to fear the word strategic. Strategic mission statements, or even worse, strategic vision documents, instill a particular terror, since these are the primary means by which corporate management techniques, setting up quantifiable methods for assessing performance, forcing teachers and scholars to spend more and more of their time assessing and justifying what they do and less time actually doing it, are insinuated into academic life. The same suspicions hold for any document that repeatedly uses the words quality, excellence, leadership, or stakeholder. So, for my own part, my immediate reaction upon hearing that Chloe was in a strategic leadership position was to suspect that not only was her job bullshit, it actively inserted bullshit into others' lives as well. According to Chloe's testimony, this was exactly the case, though if at first, not precisely for the reasons I imagined. Chloe: the reason that my dean's role was a bullshit job is the same reason that all non-executive deans, PVCs, provost chancellors, and other strategic roles in universities are bullshit jobs. The real roles of power and responsibility within a university trace the flow of money through the organization. An executive PVC or dean, in other words, he or she who holds the budget, can cajole, coerce, encourage, bully, and negotiate with departments about what they can, ought, or might want to do, using the stick or carrot of money. Strategic deans and other such roles have no carrots or sticks. They are non-executive. They hold no money, just, as was once described to me, the power of persuasion and influence. I did not sit on university leadership, and so was not part of the bun fights about targets, overall strategy, performance measures, audits, etc. I had no budget. I had no authority over the buildings, the timetable, or any other operational matters. All I could do was come up with a new strategy that was, in effect, a respin of already agreed upon university strategies. So her primary role was to come up with yet another strategic vision statement, of the kind that are regularly deployed to justify the number crunching and box ticking that has become so central to British academic life. As we shall see, this is no less true of America or anywhere else. But since Chloe had no actual power, it was all meaningless shadow play. What she did get was what all high-level university administrators now receive as their primary badge of honor: her own tiny empire of administrative staff. Chloe, I was given a 75% full-time equivalent personal assistant, a 75% full-time equivalent special project and policy support officer, and a full-time postdoctoral research fellow, plus an expenses allowance of £20,000. In other words, a shedload of public money went into supporting a bullshit job. The project and policy support officer was there to help me with projects and policies. The PA was brilliant, but ended up just being a glorified travel agent and diary secretary. The research fellow was a waste of time and money because I am a lone scholar and don't actually need an assistant. So I spent 2 years of my life making up work for myself and for other people. Actually, Chloe appears to have been a very generous boss. As she spent her own hours developing strategies she knew would be ignored, her special projects officer ran around doing timetable scenarios and gathering useful statistics. The personal assistant kept her diary, and the research fellow spent her time working on her own personal research. This, in itself, seems perfectly innocent. At least none of them was doing any harm. Who knows? Maybe the research fellow even ended up making an important contribution to human knowledge of her own. The truly disturbing thing about the whole arrangement, according to Chloe, was her ultimate realization that if she had been given real power, she probably would have done harm. Because after 2 years as dean, she was unwise enough to accept a gig as head of her old department and was thus able to see things from the other side. That is, before quitting 6 months later in horror and disgust. Chloe. My very brief stint as head of department reminded me that at the very minimum, 90% of the role is bullshit. Filling out the forms that the faculty dean sends so that she can write her strategy documents that get sent up the chain of command. Producing a confetti of paperwork as part of the auditing and monitoring of research activities and teaching activities. Producing plan after plan after 5-year plan, justifying why departments need to have the money and staff they already have. Doing bloody annual appraisals that go into a drawer never to be looked at again. And, in order to get these tasks done, as HOD, you ask your staff to help out. Bullshit proliferation. So what do I think? It is not capitalism per se that produces the bullshit. Here, Chloe seems to be responding to the title of a version of my original essay that had run on evonomics.com under the title, Why Capitalism Creates Pointless Jobs. I didn't make up the title. Normally, I avoid attributing agency to abstractions. It is managerialist ideologies put into practice in complex organizations. As managerialism embeds itself, you get entire cadres of academic staff whose job it is just to keep the managerialist plate spinning. Strategies, performance targets, audits, reviews, appraisals, renewed strategies, etc., etc., which happen in an almost wholly and entirely disconnected fashion from the real lifeblood of universities, teaching and education. On this, I will leave Chloe the last word. Chloe at least was allocated her staff first and only then had to figure out how to keep them occupied. Tanya, who had a series of taskmaster jobs in both the public and private sectors, provides us with an explanation of how entirely new bullshit positions can come about. This last testimony is unique because it explicitly incorporates the typology developed in this chapter. Toward the end of my research, I laid out my then nascent 5-part division on Twitter to encourage comments, amendments, or reactions. Tanya felt the terms fit her experience well. Tanya. I might be a taskmaster in your taxonomy of BS jobs. I was one of 2 deputy directors of an administrative services office that handled HR, budget, grants, contracts, and travel for 2 bureaus with total resources of about $600 million and 1,000 souls. At some point as a manager, or as a duct taper helping to fill functional gaps, you realize that you need to hire a new person to meet an organizational need. Most of the time, the needs I'm trying to fill are either my own need for a box ticker or a duct taper, or the needs of other managers, sometimes to hire people for non-BS work, or to hire their ration of goons and flunkies. The reason I need duct tapers is usually because I have to compensate for poorly functioning program management systems, both automated and human workflows, and in some cases, a poorly functioning box ticker and even a non-BS job subordinate who has job tenure and 25 years of outstanding performance ratings from a succession of previous bosses. This last is important. Even in corporate environments, it is very difficult to remove an underling for incompetence if that underling has seniority and a long history of good performance reviews. As in government bureaucracies, the easiest way to deal with such people is often to kick them upstairs, promote them to a higher post where they become somebody else's problem. But Tanya was already at the top of this particular hierarchy, so an incompetent would continue to be her problem even if kicked upstairs. She was left with two options. Either she could move the incompetent into a bullshit position where he had no meaningful responsibilities, or, if no such position was currently available, she could leave him in place and hire someone else to really do his job. But if you take the latter course, another problem arises. You can't recruit someone for the incompetent's job, since the incompetent already has that job. Instead, you have to make up a new job with an elaborate job description that you know to be bullshit because, really, you're hiring that person to do something else. Then you have to go through the motions of pretending the new person is ideally qualified to do the made-up job you don't really want him or her to do. All this involves a great deal of work. Tanya. In organizations with structured job classifications and position descriptions, there has to be an established and classified job to which you can recruit someone. This is a whole professional universe of BS jobs and boondogglery unto itself. It's similar to the world of people who write grant proposals or contract bids. So, the creation of a BS job often involves creating a whole universe of BS narrative that documents the purpose and functions of the position, as well as the qualifications required to successfully perform the job, while corresponding to the format and special bureaucraties prescribed by the Office of Personnel Management and my agency's HR staff. Once that's done, there has to be a narrative job announcement of the same ilk. To be eligible for hire, the applicant must present a resume incorporating all the themes and phraseology of the announcement so that the hiring software our agency uses will recognize their qualifications. After the person is hired, their duties must be spelled out in yet another document that will form the basis for annual performance appraisals. I have rewritten candidates' resumes myself to ensure that they defeat the hiring software so I can be allowed to interview and select them. If they don't make it past the computer, I can't consider them. To present a parable version, imagine you are a feudal lord again. You acquire a gardener. After 20 years of faithful service, the gardener develops a serious drinking problem. You keep finding him curled up in flower beds while dandelions sprout everywhere and the sedge begins to die. But the gardener is well connected, and getting rid of him would offend people you don't feel it would be wise to offend. So you acquire a new servant, ostensibly to polish the doorknobs or perform some other meaningless task. In fact, you make sure the person you get as doorknob polisher is actually an experienced gardener. So far, so good. The problem is, in a corporate environment, you can't just summon a new servant, make up an impressive-sounding title for him, High Seneschal of the Entryways, and tell him his real job is to take over when the gardener is drunk. You have to come up with an elaborate fake description of what a doorknob polisher would in fact do. Coach your new gardener in how to pretend he's the best doorknob polisher in the kingdom, and then use the description of his duties as the basis of periodic box-ticking performance reviews. And, if the gardener sobers up and doesn't want some young punk messing with his business, now you have a full-time doorknob polisher on your hands. This, according to Tanya, is just one of the many ways that taskmasters end up creating bullshit jobs. On complex multi-form bullshit jobs. These five categories are not exhaustive, and new types could certainly be proposed. One compelling suggestion I heard was for a category of imaginary friends. That is, people hired ostensibly to humanize an inhuman corporate environment, but who, in fact, mainly force people to go through elaborate games of make-believe. We will be hearing about forced creativity and mindfulness seminars and obligatory charity events later on. There are workers whose entire careers are based on dressing up in costumes or otherwise designing silly games to create rapport in office environments where everyone would probably be happier just being left alone. These could be seen as box tickers of a sort, but they could equally be seen as a phenomenon unto themselves. As the previous examples suggest, it can also sometimes be clear that a job is bullshit, but still be difficult to determine precisely which of the five categories it belongs to. Often, it may seem to contain elements of several. A box ticker might also be a flunky, or might end up becoming a mere flunky if the organization's internal rules change. A flunky might also be a part-time duct taper, or become a full-time duct taper if a problem arises and, instead of fixing it, the boss decides it would be easier to just reassign one of his idle minions to deal with the effects. Consider Chloe the non-executive dean. In a way, she too was a flunky, since her post was created by higher-ups for largely symbolic reasons. But she was also a taskmaster to her own subordinates. Since she and her subordinates didn't have much to do, she spent some of her time looking for problems they could duct tape until she finally came to the realization that even if she were given some kind of power, most of what she'd be doing would just be box-ticking exercises anyway. I received one testimony from a man who worked for a telemarketing company with a contract with a major IT firm. Let's say Apple. I don't know if it was Apple. He didn't tell me which one it was. His job was to call up corporations and try to convince them to book a meeting with an Apple sales representative. The problem was that all of the firms they would call already had an Apple sales rep permanently attached to them, often working out of the same office. What's more, they were perfectly aware of this. Jim. I often asked my managers how they would convince prospects of the value of taking a meeting with a sales rep from our technology giant customer when they already had a sales rep from that same technology giant on their premises. Some were as hapless as I was, but the more effective managers patiently explained to me that I was missing the point. An appointment-setting call is a game of social niceties. Prospects don't take a meeting because they think it might help solve a business problem. They take it because they fear it would be impolite not to. This is as pointless can be, but how exactly would one classify it? Certainly, Jim, being a telemarketer, would qualify as a goon. But he was a goon whose entire purpose was to maneuver people into box ticking. Another ambiguous multiform category are flack catchers, who might be considered a combination of flunky and duct taper, but who have certain unique characteristics of their own. Flack catchers are subordinates hired to be at the receiving end of often legitimate complaints, but who are given that role precisely because they have absolutely no authority to do anything about them. The flack catcher is, of course, a familiar role in any bureaucracy. The man whose job it was to apologize for the fact that the carpenter didn't come might be considered a flack catcher of sorts, but if so, his position was an unusually cushy one, since he only really had to talk to university professors and administrators who were unlikely to scream, pound the table, or become visibly upset. In other contexts, flack catching can be genuinely dangerous. When I first came to the United Kingdom in 2008, one of the first things that struck me was the ubiquity of the notices in public places reminding citizens not to physically attack minor government officials. It struck me, this should rather go without saying, but apparently it doesn't. Sometimes flack catchers are well aware of what they're there for, as with Nathaniel, who signed up for a work-study program at a college in Canada, and was assigned to sit in the registrar's office and call people to tell them that some form was filled out incorrectly and they'd have to do it all over again. Since all frontline workers were students, it kept the cap on how pissed off anyone could reasonably get. The first line you used when someone became agitated was, "Sorry, man, I know it's BS. I'm a student too." Other flat catchers seemed touchingly innocent. Tim. I work in a college dormitory during the summer. I have worked at this job for 3 years, and at this point, it is still completely unclear to me what my actual duties are. Primarily, it seems that my job consists of physically occupying space at the front desk. This is what I spend approximately 70% of my time doing. While engaged in this, I am free to pursue my own projects, which I take to mean mainly screwing around and creating rubber band balls out of rubber bands I find in the cabinets. When I am not busy with this, I might be checking the office email account. I have basically no training or administrative power, of course, so all I can do is forward these emails to my boss, moving packages from the door where they get dropped off to the package room, answering phone calls. Again, I know nothing and rarely answer a question to the caller's satisfaction. Finding ketchup packets from 2005 in the desk drawers, or calling maintenance to report that a resident has dropped 3 forks down the garbage disposal and now the sink is spewing decayed food. In addition, often people will yell at me for things that are clearly not my fault, such as the fact that they dropped 3 forks down the garbage disposal, or the fact that there is construction happening nearby, or the fact that they have not paid their outstanding rent balance, and I am forbidden from accepting $1,400 in cash, and my boss does not work on weekends, or the fact that there is no convenient TV available on which they can watch The Bachelor. I assume it's a kind of catharsis for them to do this yelling, since I am 19 years old and clearly abjectly powerless. For these duties, I am paid $14 an hour. On the surface, it may seem as if Tim is just a flunky, like the unnecessary receptionist in the Dutch publishing house. It just wouldn't look good to have no one sitting there at all. But in fact, it seems likely that insofar as Tim provides a real service to his employers, it's precisely by giving angry students someone they can vent at. Why else, after 3 years, would they still be keeping him so completely in the dark? The main reason I hesitate to make flat catcher a category of bullshit job is because this is a real service. Tim is not making up for a structural flaw like the man whose job it was to apologize for the fact that the carpenter didn't come. He's there because if you gather together a large number of teenagers, a few will invariably throw temper tantrums about stupid things, and Tim's employer would prefer they direct their outrage at someone other than himself. In other words, Tim's is a shit job, but it's not entirely clear that it's a bullshit one. A word on second-order bullshit jobs. A final ambiguous category consists of jobs which are in no sense pointless in and of themselves, but which are ultimately pointless because they are performed in support of a pointless enterprise. An obvious example would be the cleaners, security, maintenance, and other support staff for a bullshit company. Take Kurt's office that provides the paperwork required to move German soldiers' computers down the hall. Or Nori's firm that promoted an algorithm that didn't work. Or any of 100 fake telemarketing or compliance firms. In every one of those offices, someone has to water the plants. Someone has to clean the toilets. Someone has to handle pest control. And while it's true that most of the companies in question operate in large office buildings hosting any number of different sorts of enterprise, which usually makes it unlikely that any one cleaner or electrician or bug sprayer is providing services exclusively for those who believe themselves to be engaged in useless occupations, if one were to measure the total proportion of cleaning or electrical work that is ultimately performed in support of bullshit, that number would be very high. One would have to assume 37%, in fact, if the YouGov survey is accurate. This must be assumed unless there is some reason to believe that pointless occupations require either more or less support work than useful ones. If 37% of jobs are bullshit, and 37% of the remaining 63% are in support of bullshit, then slightly over 50% of all labor falls into the bullshit sector in the broadest sense of the term. This figure is obviously inexact. On the one hand, a very large percentage of cleaners, electricians, builders, etc. work for private individuals and not for firms at all. On the other hand, I am counting the 13% who say they aren't sure if their jobs are bullshit or non-bullshit jobs. The 50% figure, actually 50.3%, is based on the assumption these two factors would roughly cancel each other out. If you combine this with the bullshitization of useful occupations, at least 50% in office work, presumably less in other sorts, and the various professions that basically exist only because everyone is working too hard, dog washers, all-night pizza delivery men, to name a few, we could probably get the real work week down to 15 hours, or even 12, without anyone noticing much. A final note, with a brief return to the question, is it possible to have a bullshit job and not know it? The idea of second-order bullshit jobs once again raises the issue of the degree to which bullshit jobs are just a matter of subjective judgment and the degree to which they have objective reality. I believe bullshit jobs to be very real. When I say we can only rely on the judgment of the worker, I'm simply talking about what we can, as observers, know about them. I would also remind the listener that, while I believe it is right to defer to the particular worker about the factual question of whether their work actually does anything at all, when it comes to the rather more subtle issue of whether the work in question does anything of value, I will think it's the best thing to defer to the overall opinion of those who work in the industry. Otherwise, we could end up in the rather silly position of saying that of 30 legal aides working in the same office and performing the same tasks, 29 have bullshit jobs because they think they do, but the one true believer who disagrees does not. Unless one takes the position that there is absolutely no reality at all except for individual perception, which is philosophically problematic, it is hard to deny the possibility that people can be wrong about what they do. For the purposes of this book, this is not that much of a problem, because what I am mainly interested in is, as I say, the subjective element. My primary aim is not so much to lay out a theory of social utility or social value as to understand the psychological, social, and political effects of the fact that so many of us labor under the secret belief that our jobs lack social utility or social value. I am also assuming that people are not usually wrong. So if one really did want to map out, say, which sectors of the economy are real and which are bullshit, the best way to do so would be to examine in which sectors the preponderance of workers feel their jobs are pointless and in which sectors the preponderance do not. Even more, one would try to tease out the tacit theory of social value that led them to this conclusion. If someone says, "My job is completely pointless," what are the unspoken criteria being applied? Some, like Tom, the special effects artist, have thought these things through and can simply tell you. In other cases, workers are not able to articulate a theory, but you can tell that one must be there, if only on a not completely conscious level. So you have to tease out the theory by examining the language people use and observing their gut reactions to the work they do. For me, this isn't really a problem. I'm an anthropologist. Teasing out the implicit theory that lies behind people's everyday actions and reactions is what anthropologists are trained to do. But then, there's the problem that people's theories are not all the same. For instance, it has come to my attention, while conducting this research, that many of those employed in the banking industry are privately convinced that 99% of what banks do is bullshit that does not benefit humanity in any way. I can only assume that others working in the industry disagree with this assessment. Is there any pattern here? Does it vary with seniority? Are higher-ups more likely to believe in the social benefits of banking? Or do many of them secretly agree that their work has no social value but just don't care? Maybe they even take delight in the knowledge that their work does not benefit the public, thinking of themselves as pirates or scam artists in some romantic sense. It's impossible to say. Though Jeffrey Sachs' testimony in the last chapter at least suggests that many at the very top simply feel they have a right to whatever they can get. The real problem for my approach comes when one has to deal with those in professions that everyone else regularly invokes as prime examples of bullshit jobs who don't seem to think of their jobs that way themselves. Again, no one has done detailed comparative survey work in this regard, but I did notice certain interesting patterns in my own data. I heard from only a smattering of lawyers, though from a large number of legal aides, only two PR flacks and not a single lobbyist. Does this mean we have to conclude these are largely non-bullshit occupations? Not necessarily. There are any number of other possible explanations for their silence. For instance, perhaps fewer of them hang around on Twitter, or maybe the ones that do are more inclined to lie. I should add as a final note, there was really only one class of people that not only denied their jobs were pointless, but expressed outright hostility to the very idea that our economy is rife with bullshit jobs. These were, predictably enough, business owners and anyone else in charge of hiring and firing. Tanya appears to be something of an exception in this regard. In fact, for many years, I have been receiving periodic unsolicited communications from indignant entrepreneurs and executives telling me my entire premise is wrong. No one, they insist, would ever spend company money on an employee who wasn't needed. Such communications rarely offer particularly sophisticated arguments. Most just employ the usual circular argument that since, in a market economy, none of the things described in this chapter could have actually occurred, that therefore they didn't. So all the people who are convinced their jobs are worthless must be deluded, or self-important, or simply don't understand their real function, which is fully visible only to those above. One might be tempted to conclude from these responses that there is at least one class of people who genuinely don't realize their jobs are bullshit. Except, of course, what CEOs do isn't really bullshit. For better or for worse, their actions do make a difference in the world. They're just blind to all the bullshit they create.